Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight, actor Sam Levine tells us how he went from being one of Judd Apatow's Freaks and Geeks to one of Quentin Tarantino's Inglourious Bastards. Coming up next on Movie Geeks United.
My name is Ted Aldo Raymond.
These are the Bastards. Ever heard of us? We'd like to say we're a big fan of your work, killing Natchez. But your status as a Natch killer is still amateur. We all come here to see if you want to go pro.
An American Secret Service outfit that lives deep behind enemy lines. The Germans call them the Bastards.
The Bastards?
Yes, because these Yanks have been them the devil.
That's about it. If you heard about us, you probably heard we ain't in the prisoner-taking business. We in the killing Nazi business. Cousin, business is up. Boom. It
sure is.
3 days from now, Joseph Goebbels is throwing a gala premiere of one of his new movies in Paris. In attendance will be most of the German high command. Basically, we have all our rotten eggs in one basket. The objective? Blow up the basket.
Nine, 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 nine!
Oh, yes, 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 yes!
There's something you don't know.
Which is?
Hitler is attending the premiere.
How do you intend to get in that premiere?
You'll rendezvous with our double agent. She'll take it from there.
So you're the Jew hunter.
That's a bingo.
Is that the way you say it? That's a bingo?
You just say bingo.
Welcome to Movie Geeks United this Sunday night. Hope everyone out there is having a great, or had a great weekend. It's almost over now, unfortunately. Jerry, how are you doing?
I'm doing really well. You had to remind me that it was almost over, though. No,
I know. I hate to start the show on a downhill
note. I know you really start that, but think of it. We're like that last great blast.
Yeah.
Before you have to go to work, so or school,
exactly.
Or whatever it is. Well, not school, or maybe summer school, but we're that last great blast, and we couldn't think of a better way to end the weekend than officially promoting the start of the promotion of Inglourious Bastards.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is enough to make a geek feel like he's died and gone to heaven.
That's
a new
right.
Tarantino movie. I mean, there's special anticipation with anything Tarantino's behind. And
that's right.
And we're so excited to welcome our first guest tonight. What a stunning career he's had, and he's still so young. I feel so old. I'm 35, and I think everyone's younger than me all of a sudden when you get to a certain age.
I know that feeling all too well at 38, so, and I've known that for 8 years, actually, to be very honest with you. But, I mean, think about it, though. Freaks and Geeks and Inglourious Bastards. And some other stuff, too. He's worked with National Lampoon.
Tons of stuff, yeah.
And Broken Lizard for Club Dread. This guy, I mean, he's had some really wonderful opportunities and wonderful exposure in his career so far.
Yeah, and I think he just called in, and I think he just hung up. As soon as we start, okay, there he is.
I have that
on
people.
All right, let's get right to it. Our guest tonight began stand-up comedy at the age of 12, was cast in Judd Apatow's critically acclaimed series Freaks and Geeks at the age of around 16, and at the age of 18, he became the youngest inductee of the New York Friars Club. He's appeared in some of our greatest TV series since his Freaks and Geeks days, including Undeclared, Family Guy, Entourage, and Life as We Know It, just to name a few. And meanwhile, his feature film career has been booming, particularly this year with roles in Chris Columbus's I Love You, Beth Cooper, and Quentin Tarantino's highly anticipated Inglourious Bastards. It is a tremendous pleasure to welcome actor-comedian Sam Levine to Movie Geeks United. Sam, how are you doing?
Wonderful, guys. Thank you for that amazingly kind introduction.
Hey, thank you for being here.
Did my mother write that introduction? Because Jesus.
Oh, yeah, and she came right in on deadline, man. She just emailed it to me before we started, so that was great.
Fantastic.
Tell me about this. This interests me. Stand-up comedian, you started your stand-up career at the age of 12, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct.
What was your material like at the age of 12?
Oh my God, it was so good. I had Gary Shandling wanted me to write jokes for him, and Rosie O'Donnell. What was my material like? It was I basically talked about like school and my teachers and girls don't like me and you know what's with his hair in weird places. You know, kid stuff.
The same stuff you're talking about now, right?
Absolutely, nothing's changed. Not a thing has changed.
But when you were growing up, were the comedians your kind of creative heroes, or were the actors your heroes?
You know, I had a lot of heroes. The comedians were great. I mean, there was one comedian who really inspired me to get into it, which is the late Richard Jenny. When he did his Platypus Man special on HBO in 93 when I was 11.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw that thing and afterward I just thought, oh man, that is what I have to do.
Mm-hmm.
That is one
right
of the
there.
Funniest shows I've ever seen.
Yeah,
he was one of the greats. And so that's what prompted me to start like writing my own jokes and you know, wanting to get up on stage and perform like that. But I mean, at the same time, I'd always loved acting and actors. But really, when I was that old, at that age, I was more interested in doing stand-up than I was acting.
I would think that stand-up would have to be the most nerve-wracking thing you could attempt. And it's so pure. It's just a guy on stage with a microphone looking out at an audience. How long did it take you to reach a comfort zone, or did you feel at home right away?
Any comedian who tells you they ever reach a comfort zone is lying. it definitely took me some time, but I had a lot of practice because before I started playing the clubs, I was playing bar mitzvahs.
Yes.
A tough audience there right there as it is.
You don't get a tougher room than a bunch of underfed, drunk Jewish people who all feel like, yeah, I know, I gave too nice of a gift for this party. Come on.
Yeah.
So,
dude, that's a tough crowd. If you can survive that, you can survive anything.
That's what I said. I said I might as well just join a USO tour because nothing, bullets just bounce off me.
That's right. But when Freaks and Geeks came around, that was a big breakthrough in terms of your acting career. But I understand that you auditioned for a different role than you eventually got, and your audition didn't go well. I guess it went well, but it was not a great audition somehow?
No, it wasn't that good an audition. I did. I originally read for Sam Weir, the role John Daly played, and this was, I was just reading for the casting director. You know, this is what we in the acting biz call a pre-read, which is just when the casting director sees you and decides whether or not you're talented enough that they should waste the producer's time with seeing you. And so I did the read, which wasn't anything special, but then at the end of it, I decided to throw in my impression of William Shatner. Because it said in the breakdown for the part, you know, Sam likes doing impressions with his friends.
Right.
So literally I finished my read and then I turned to the casting director off camera because they were taping me and I go, can I do it now? And she,
yeah.
And so then I did my Shatner and then she showed that tape to Judd Apatow on the West Coast. And when Judd saw the tape, he didn't particularly care for my read, but he liked that I did the Shatner,
mm-hmm.
and knew that Paul Feig was coming into New York the following week to see the actors who were coming in for callbacks. And so he put me on the callback list truly with only the intention of having me do Shatner for Paul just to make him laugh. And mercifully, Paul had the bright idea to have me read for the character Neil, and the rest is history.
Thanks, so is William Shatner.
Yeah, is Shatner aware that he's responsible for your acting career?
Yeah.
I don't think he is, and I tried to talk to him recently. I ran into him at a Billy Joel Elton John concert,
mm-hmm.
Out in Anaheim, and apparently he has mad cow disease. Sorry to have to break that news
here
on the show.
Wait, how does he have mad cow disease?
Yeah, he has mad cow disease, because I said, William, and I'm standing literally right in front of him,
mm-hmm.
and he did not turn to acknowledge me. And then I said, Mr. Shatner, and he, again, would not turn to acknowledge me. And then I finally said, Bill, and he just walked on by as if I wasn't there. So really, there's only two reasonable excuses for that. One, he's a gigantic asshole, or two, he's clearly just an old man with mad cow disease.
Right,
and
right.
Since he is beloved to us all, it must be the latter.
I'm going to go with you on that. I'm not going to argue with that. That sounds fair
it's
enough.
It's got to be the latter. There's only two possible scientific explanations, and I'm going to go with that. So there you go. Boutique Geeks United, you guys have the scoop.
That is a big scoop.
That's an enormous scoop.
We'll start publicizing that right away. The Judd Apatow experience,
mm-hmm.
was it obvious to you from the beginning what his magical formula, what his particular stamp was, and how would you describe his style?
I would say, I mean, if we're talking Freaks and Geeks, as much credit as Judd deserves for it, Paul Feig deserves equal credit. And so between the two of them, I would say the stamp, the style for that show was real life.
Okay.
You know, real life isn't boring. You know, that's what networks are always afraid of. Well, we can't make it too realistic, otherwise it's not interesting. Yes, it is.
Yeah, it really is.
It is interesting, you know, and the lead characters don't always have to have victories. And, you know, and they can be embarrassed, and
mm-hmm.
things can get awkward and uncomfortable. And, you know, shows were afraid to do that before Freaks and Geeks. And hell, some of them are still afraid to because shit. Look what happened to Freaks and Geeks.
Those are some of the best stories, though, because people can relate to that. I mean, you can still be funny and you can still have the failure, but that's what people respond to in the end. That's what lasts.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
But it's curious, though. And I guess it speaks to how tough the TV business is, because Freaks and Geeks was obviously critically acclaimed. The people that were into the show were fanatical about it, and yet it didn't have a long run. But when were you aware that it started capturing, I guess, in a way, cult status?
It was, you know, it didn't really achieve that cult status when we were shooting it. Like, I knew it was good when we were shooting it, because I'd been watching TV my whole life, and I just knew this is better. Like, if I were watching the show, I would know this would be my favorite show. And but nobody really watched the time, and it didn't get culty until after it was canceled. Then it became this kind of, oh my God, can you believe they canceled that great thing that nobody saw? But it was so great, but nobody saw it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I started to get an idea of, well, all right, now we're going to be like this mythical show that didn't even exist kind of thing. And then when the DVDs came out in 2004, that was really what gave it that big push. That made it this beloved little critical darling that, you know, went away before it had its chance.
Yeah, DVD has really resurrected a lot of great television series and films, too. It's been a great medium for that.
Yeah.
I know you get asked about this a lot, but I
No, I'll answer before you can even finish.
Okay,
when I worked on That's So Raven... Raven is exactly like you think she is. In fact, sometimes she would do stuff so outrageous on set, I would just turn to the people around me and go, "That is so Raven." And I'd get a high five. Yeah.
Classic.
Oh, well, that's it. Interview's over. That's all I want.
Okay,
really.
Great.
Okay,
glad we covered it.
The Friars Club.
Yes, sir.
You are the youngest inductee. How did that occur? I think you were sponsored by a couple of your comedian friends.
I was.
What I'm
Elon Gold and Jeff Ross. From
Jeff Ross, yeah. What I'm curious about is, what is it? What are your responsibilities as a member of that club?
Well, my responsibilities are fairly simple. I have to always speak well of the club, make sure I wear a jacket after 4, and every year for Hanukkah, we sacrifice a Christian baby.
That's what we do at my house.
Ooh, wait, I'm sorry. I'm not supposed to talk about that.
No,
we can edit that out, right?
It's public knowledge. I mean, all the conspiracy theorists believe it, so why not?
So
no, it's
here's how it happened. Like we talked about before, I've been doing stand-up since I'm 12, and so I'd been a stand-up for 4 years when I got invited to the Friars Club for the first time. And I immediately fell in love with the place. I mean, my first time there, I go up to the bar, and I'm sitting there with Freddie Roman and Dick Capri, and
wow.
I mean, just living legends
mm-hmm.
of, you know, Borscht-Belt Jewish comedy. And these guys are telling stories. It's a, all right, so it's 1956, and I'm banging Mitzi Shore in the back of a Copacabana. And I'm like, well, I don't know how I can live the rest of my life without being here every day.
Exactly. Well, that's great. That's great.
Yeah, so I was like, oh, well, this is where I need to hang out from now on, you know. And so I said to a couple of my comedian friends, I'm like, I got to get in this club. And
right.
and so they pitched me to Freddie and the late Alan King, and they were like, ah, you're cute, you're funny, we know you should be in the club, but crap, we got to open bars here. I mean, you got to be 21. We've never had anyone this young want to be a member. I'll tell you what, wait till you're 18. We'll see what we can do then. And, I waited patiently for 2 more years, and like the day I turned 18, I called Freddie Roman. I was like, can I get in? And he said, yes, yes, we'll start the process. And so, like I said, Elon Gold and the Roastmaster General, Jeffrey Ross, sponsored me. And, you know, I met with some members of the club, and they interviewed me. And then that was it. They said, yeah, you can be one of us.
Wow. Have you participated in any of the roasts?
I have. Ever since the ones that haven't been televised, you know, it's not as easy to be seen, but I've done some stuff for the roast, which is always fun. But
yeah.
But nothing that was televised or mm-hmm. Picked up by the media.
Tell me about, we're switching gears here, but Inglourious Basterds, how did this opportunity come about for you?
Well, I had some incriminating photos of Harvey Weinstein.
That
and,
would do it all the time.
Yeah, and I was able to avoid the hitmen.
Mm-hmm.
How did it happen? I met Quentin 6 years ago. I met him when he was out promoting the Kill Bill movies,
mm-hmm.
and he is actually a big Freaks and Geeks fan. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, he and I got to talking a long time ago, and he's a really amazing guy, and you know, he finished this nice chat we had by, you know, saying, hey, I hope we get to work together someday, and you know, turns out he's a man of his word, because, you know, last summer when he was casting this film, you know, he called me in to come meet with him for it, and so, you know, that was really it. He just called me in.
So, what kind of feeling did that give you? Because this is, it's not only a Tarantino film, which is big enough, but
yeah.
This is really a passion project for Tarantino, something that he's had in his back pocket for many years.
A decade almost, it seems.
Yeah. So what was that like for you?
I mean, it was one of the most incredible experiences I've ever had, you know, to get to work with, you know, a guy who has provided me with such inspiration
mm-hmm.
and you know, over the years and entertainment and love for cinema and filmmaking.
Right.
It was really a treat. He's the nicest guy. He loves making movies is his catchphrase on set. And
right.
It's every word of it is true. It was really a treat for me, you know, a film lover to get to work with him. And boy, I hope we get to do it again.
What can you tell us about the character that you play, if anything?
I play a character named PFC Hirschberg, who's you know, one of the guys in the unit,
mm-hmm.
Brad Pitt's command, who you know, we get dropped behind enemy lines in Nazi occupied France.
Right.
And we want to scare the crap out of the Nazi soldiers.
Okay, cool.
You know,
they've
been talking about the movie and one take on it, and I know Quentin's been asked about it, and I want to ask you about it. People have been saying that the film almost plays like a Jewish revenge fantasy. What are your thoughts on that?
In some ways, it's a little bit of that, but, I mean, here's how I feel about it at the end of the day, and this will definitely make more sense once, you know, you've seen the film, but it's definitely a story about revenge, but it's really a story about the powers of film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, literally and figuratively, and how, especially during wartime, film was used so much to either inform or misinform,
mm-hmm.
You know, about how people should feel. And the whole movie is very film lover centric in everything
mm-hmm.
that we do. And so it's as much about that and how powerful film is as it is a story about revenge and, you know, the Jewish struggle during, you know, World War II.
Yeah, I don't take it. I mean, you know, as well, I agree with Jamie. I understand what he's saying. I don't take a Tarantino film to really be specifically about that. While revenge is a very big component of his later films, this movie really does sound like, just given the plot and everything and some of the scenes in it, a film-centric, as you say, view of the war, or any war for that matter.
And I feel that
way
absolutely. Every time I watch a Tarantino movie. It makes me excited about movies again.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And speaking of exciting, just working with Tarantino is exciting enough, but writing the wave of this film, you got to go to the Cannes Film Festival for the first time, and
yeah.
where Quentin is a hero.
He is a living legend
mm-hmm.
at Cannes, yeah.
Yeah. What was that like for you?
That was insane. That was the closest I think I'll ever come to feeling like a Beatle.
wow. Okay.
When you're walking up that red carpet to the Palais, the big movie theater where they showed the movie that night, I've never seen such an ocean of people.
Mm.
I mean, it was like being on a stage at Woodstock. I've honestly never in my life seen that many people all crammed against barriers trying to get a glimpse of Quentin or Brad, and just losing it for any actor in the film, and so many photographers. I didn't know there were that many cameras in the world. Blind for a day and a half from the flashes. It was really an incredible experience.
I imagine so. Yeah.
And I understand that he had a limited amount of time to shoot it because he wanted to make the Cannes date.
Yeah.
So I think it was shot at a pretty breakneck pace. I'm wondering if you could talk about just the environment of shooting the film and the camaraderie between the guys and the pace of it, and any thoughts you might have on the experience.
The pace was good. It didn't feel rushed. I mean, they shot the film over the course of about 5 months. Really, the thing that was rushed was the post-production.
Mm-hmm.
Quentin finished post-production in 8 weeks after the film, which is ridiculous when you think that most films, especially a film of that caliber, should have had a post-production of 8 months.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So, I mean, he had Sally Menke, his amazing editor, on location.
They're married
with
to each other. They're
oh, yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Her husband said, you should just marry Quentin while you're at it.
Professionally.
Yeah.
They are, creatively, they are married to one another. She was in Berlin with us for, you know, the first month and a half. So, I mean, by the time he shot in sequence, which doesn't happen really ever, because that's the most expensive way to shoot.
Yeah.
But that's exactly what he did, because it was really the only way that Sally could edit the film as he was shooting to you know, start getting it done in time for Cannes. So, I mean, the pacing felt natural. It didn't feel forced. But, I mean, the camaraderie was incredible, because when you have a guy like Quentin, you know, as the captain of the ship, no one ever doubts that captain for a minute.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
You know, if he says, we're going this way into this horrible storm, everyone said, absolutely, let's go. You know, full steam ahead, let's do it.
Well, I wish you the best of luck with it, and I don't. I'm sure you won't need it. I'm sure it'll do gangbuster business. But
thank you.
I want to ask you before you leave. You're wanting to get back into stand-up, or is that something you're pursuing? Because you've been away from it.
It is. It's something I have. I've been away from it for a good number of years now. It's something I've been thinking about. I've been doing a lot of like live performance, mostly storytelling stuff, the last few years, and it may have given me the taste to get back out there. So, it's something I'm thinking about.
Well, you keep us up to date about everything you're doing. Yeah, and we're crazy about you, man, and we appreciate your time so much tonight.
Thank you.
Oh, well, thank you so much. This was great.
Thank you, Sam.
Thank you, Sam.
Okay.
Bye-bye now.
Okay, bye.
Sam Levine, Inglourious Basterds. You can see him in that film. That's August 21st, I believe, isn't it?
Yeah, August 21st.
Yeah,
it's really funny. There's a Robert Rodriguez children's film that comes out the same day called Shorts. And it's just very interesting. They're going head-to-head.
Yeah, I think they're vying for different audiences.
I know. They're all vying for different audiences, obviously. But
and you
know,
can see
kids, I'd take them to see Inglourious Basterds. But
you can see Sam right now on I Love You, Beth Cooper, which is currently in release. All right.
Hey, I want to see I Love You, Beth Cooper, you know? I mean, I definitely want to check that out. It looks kind of funny, so, you know?
Well, it's Chris Columbus. He's another great director. He's having a lot of awesome opportunities, and he's, man, what a resume. What a life so
far.
Yeah,
dude, it's an amazing resume, an amazing life, no doubt about that.
But we thank him so much for giving his time tonight and telling us all about Tarantino and giving us the scoop on Shatner's Mad Cow.
Yeah, I know. I'll never really look at Shatner the same way again. And here I thought he was upset maybe because he really realized he messed up by not being in the new Star Trek. But okay.
Here's I want to talk about some movies.
Okay. Let's talk about Bruno.
Okay, let's talk about Bruno. You talked about this briefly last week, and I've seen it now, and I think it bears some additional analysis.
Yeah, dude, you go for it, and I'll jump in when I can.
Yeah, here's a taste of it. A taste of Bruno.
I hired a top photographer and held a casting for the hottest baby photo shoot ever.
Is your baby comfortable with bees, wasps, and hornets?
George is comfortable with everything, so he's fine.
Is he comfortable with dead or dying animals?
Yes.
Great. Is she okay with extremely rapid acceleration?
Yes.
Okay. Does she always have to be in a car seat, or can she just, like, freestyle it?
Oh, yeah, you can freestyle it, put her in a car seat, whatever.
If it looks better without the car seat.
Of course, of course.
So what? You're traveling fast, you're not going to kill it.
Of course, of course.
Is your baby fine with lit phosphorus?
Yes.
Excellent. Does he like it?
Loves it.
Oh, God.
Yeah.
Anyway, I saw this yesterday, and I was really gravely kind of disappointed in it.
That seems to be the sentiment around. I mean, it's not a popular film in that regard.
Yeah, and I was kind of conflicted about why I felt that way. I did laugh at a couple of sections of it.
There's some laugh-out-loud parts, no doubt.
I guess I had something in mind that I wanted it to be, and it wasn't that. Part of it might be the novelty of that style has worn off, but I don't think so, as much as I think that Borat was a travelogue of America, really. That's what it felt like to me. And I wanted Bruno to feel like the same thing. I think Bruno is too reliant on plot somehow to really bring out as many of the moments as I wanted.
Right.
Because I wanted more of a sense of the attitudes of people across America.
Right. And you only get like really a small segment of that, like a small sampling of that attitude from one portion of the country.
Yeah, particularly, exactly. And I thought that there's a lot of comedy that was mined out of the idea that he wanted to go straight.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great swingers party.
Yeah, the swingers party is one of those things that is just that scene where he's talking to the guy while he's with the girl. I was just like, oh my God. I think, you know, after Borat, I rented the Ali G movie that never had a theatrical release yet.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, there are parts of that I like, but it seemed to me, after watching that, now especially after watching Bruno, you know, more than a half hour is a little bit too much for some of these characters, you know? A full-length feature film is, you know, it doesn't always work.
Yeah, but I didn't feel that way
about
it. It did work for Borat. I didn't feel that way with Borat because there was enough variety in the kind of people they targeted. And
he went after a larger segment of the population than he did.
Yeah, and there was some insight that came from this. I mean, with Bruno, maybe it's all one note. Maybe he's just meeting with intolerance. Mm-hmm. And that's the only note that there is.
Right. Like with the martial arts instructor.
Well, that was... But
you know what I mean? Like, it's that same response, or with the hunters, when he goes on the hunting party, it's that same kind of response.
Right. But you can... the thing about it is you can talk about these individual scenes,
mm-hmm.
and they're funny when you're describing
yeah.
them. But somehow in the fabric of the whole, it wasn't as effective as it needed to be. There's something lacking. It just
mm-hmm.
felt kind of lackluster to me. It didn't reveal anything, really.
Well, no.
And I wanted it to. And I thought this subject matter, particularly with, you know, this taboo people have against gay people for whatever reason.
Right. No.
I thought it was hype for parody, for exploration.
I think the thing is, you know, one of the arguments that's been leveled against the film is that, you know, instead of like showing that parody, that satire, it's almost as though he's encouraging homophobia in some ways.
It feels like that more.
Yeah,
than...
it does. At times, it does feel like that. I won't say throughout the whole movie, but at times, it does feel like his plan is backfiring, and you're almost giving in to this homophobic stance that does exist in the country.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I'm very conflicted about the movie. At the base level, I can say that I didn't laugh very much, and I was ready to. I really
right,
wanted
yeah,
to.
If people laughed a lot, a guy I work with thought I couldn't stop laughing. There are parts I thought they were funny, and there are other things I thought just fell flat, and, you know, as a whole, I can't say I really remember much about the film like I did about Borat.
But I could tell in the theater that people wanted to laugh.
Mm-hmm.
And it is something else. They were wanting to laugh, but they weren't given much to laugh at.
Mm-hmm. That's a fair criticism, yeah.
And then you watch something like Gran Torino.
Mm-hmm.
When Eastwood, I mean, it's a funny performance, I guess, in a way, for much of it. But people are just on the floor, rolling over, laughing. That's what they did in my theater when I went to see it. And
yeah.
Part of that, in the back of your mind, you're thinking, part of that's a little troubling, because where's that laughter coming from?
Yeah, I think with Gran Torino, though, it's also because it's Eastwood doing it, and it's almost like because there hasn't been a character like that for a while, there's almost, it felt like for me at least, there was a release.
Yeah.
I think I saw it with a majority white audience, and this was in limited release at an art house theater, and it was almost like kind of that nervous laughter almost at first,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
but then you get the vibe of the character, and, you know, yeah, he is, you know, the things he say are despicable, but it's who the character is. It's not like Eastwood is condoning this or anything. I mean, he makes it very clear there's a character. This guy's a relic, really, from another time. He doesn't know any better in one sense.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's different. I mean, I understand the point you're trying to make to Bruno, but it's a different kind of thing because it serves the purpose, and it really works very well towards the end of the movie, the conclusion, the irony, if you will.
I suppose it does.
Bruno,
I want to talk...
troubling, though, in the sense, though, I do think it, instead of being the satire it wants to be at times, it does fuel the flames of, homophobic feeling.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, that's the big question.
But it's not a big hit either, as we've seen.
Yeah. Harry Potter's obviously the big hit this week, and we'll talk about that in just a second.
Mm-hmm.
First, I want to talk about something interesting, some casting news.
Mm-hmm.
Concerning Rod Laurie's Straw Dogs.
Mm, okay.
First, let's play this clip. When we spoke to Rod Laurie, I think it was in December in relation to his movie Nothing But the Truth. We asked him about Straw Dogs, his upcoming remake of Peckinpah Straw Dogs, and this is what he had to say.
My next film is going to be a studio film, and I got a very ballsy studio head who's going to give me a lot of a lot of rain when I make it. And it's,
yeah, is that Straw Dogs you're talking about?
Yeah, and that film was a tiny bit before my time. It came out when I was 9 years old, and I didn't get to see it in the theaters. But you know, hopefully we'll be able to make a studio film that has the guts and the energy of an independent film.
I want to get to Nothing But the Truth as soon as possible. But since we brought up Straw Dogs, let me ask you one question. In your mind, in your script, where do you see the relevancy of that story to today?
Well, you know, first of all, it's a really great story, and you know, that I think is kind of an evergreen. But you know, back in its day, some people made you know, Vietnam analogy to it, and I suppose what you're asking is, what would be the modern analogy? Mm-hmm. And my answer is, I don't think it was a Vietnam analogy. You know, there's nothing in the literature about that, and Pakenpah, when interviewed, always poo-pooed the idea. And you know, he just wanted to tell you know, a really good story, and a story about human character. And I look at it as you know, as a movie that is a sort of a personification about. I want to, you know, it's difficult to say because people always sort of jump. Every word I say about this movie, people jump out and say that the filmmaker doesn't understand the movie. You know, he's taking completely the wrong direction. But I really look at it as a movie about human cruelty and how we really are all capable of it, and that decency really is the magic of not allowing our baser instincts to take over. And so I think that all the characters in the film have some amount of culpability in how the film ends. Not in the rape scene, which is the most famous, but in the shootout at the end of the film.
Well, Jerry and I both have talked about it, and we're really looking forward to it. We're not precious at all about a remake of Straw Dogs like some people are. See. Yeah.
The film is not necessarily a great film by any stretch of the imagination. It's not as good. You know, I wouldn't dare to remake The Wild Bunch. He was infamously, hospitalized for his drunkenness or his alcohol intake when he made that film, and you can see that there's some things that are rather incomprehensible in the film. It's interesting. We're thinking about who we want to cast right now. It's a long process. We want to do right. We want to do something that's really exciting.
Yeah.
When we cast it, we want whoever we choose to be a shock to the system. And we're going to do something very, you know, very exciting with the movie. I think so. We'll see. We'll see.
Okay, that's what he had to say about Straw Dogs.
Can I interject something?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, I don't think it's. How should I say? I think it's a great film. I don't think it's one of Peckinpah's great films, because when you have The Wild Bunch and Cross of Iron, it's kind of really hard to get near either one of those films, but I think it's a great film. It's probably my favorite Dustin Hoffman performance, even more so than The Graduate. But I don't think it's a sacred cow, because I think a film like that is definitely open up to a 21st century interpretation. Mm-hmm. But it's a powerful film, and it rubbed people the wrong way like A Clockwork Orange when it came out. I mean, it really... I think Vincent Canby, actually, if I'm not mistaken, gave it one of the few good reviews it got. But... It rubbed people the wrong way. It pissed people off, and I appreciate.
And Pauline Kael, who was a big champion of Peckinpah for much of his career,
she hated it, right? If I'm not.
She
mistaken.
Hated it, yeah. And which led Peckinpah to write Pauline Kael a letter that they published, defending himself.
Mm-hmm.
The movie has been cast. The main characters in the film has been cast, and some new light has been shed on the direction he's taking with it. If you guys remember the original Straw Dogs. I forget which little village or little town they went to.
It was in England, though, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, he was a mathematician or something. Mm-hmm. He was very interior,
very nerdy, you know, if you want to.
Wormy and nerdy, yeah. And he was married to a gorgeous, vivacious, kind of sexually charged woman. Yes,
Susan George, if I'm not mistaken.
And the townspeople, a lot of the town bullies, had their eyes on his wife, and it turned out to be. Following a rape scene involving his wife, he had to take a stand for his home and what was his, and he had to get in touch with the inner violence in himself. Or, you know, it was a classic Peckinpah theme.
Mm-hmm.
So it has been recast. It has been cast for Rod Laurie's remake. James Marsden is going to play the Dustin Hoffman role.
Wow.
which I'm not necessarily down on that. I think Marsden has a nice presence. I'm interested
in. Yes, he does, but he's not who we. It's an interesting choice because he's a very handsome.
Yeah.
Actor.
Well, and Kate Bosworth has been cast as his wife.
Oh my God! It's like Superman Returns sequel.
Oh, that's right. They were together in Superman Returns, weren't they? And Alexander Skarsgård, who is. He's one of the vampires in True Blood.
Oh, yeah.
Eric, I guess?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, and he's one of the Skarsgård siblings, I guess. He's the son of Peter, Stellan.
Stellan, yes.
And he's very good. He's cast as, I guess, the guy in the town that takes Bosworth and has to have Marsden prove his manhood later on in the movie.
Oh,
but this is the revised plot. Marsden plays a Hollywood screenwriter who relocates with his wife to her hometown in Mississippi. Bosworth plays the wife who left the South to become an actress and returns home so her husband can finish his script in quiet. Skarsgård plays her high school boyfriend, an ex-football hero who sees the return of his former girlfriend as a way to reclaim glory.
Wow. Sounds like a really violent reimagining of Sweet Home Alabama with Reese Witherspoon almost. And that's not a slight.
Yeah,
well,
I know what you're saying.
I appreciate what he's doing, but I just thought of this when listening to the interview again.
Yeah.
This has been remade, kind of, not completely, in the Anthony Hopkins movie The Edge, which was originally called Bookworm.
Right.
So I really am curious what Rod Laurie is going to do here, because I like Nothing But the Truth a lot. I think he's a fascinating guy, and I think if anyone can do this for the 21st century, it's him.
Yeah, I do like him. I think he's great, but my argument is, it seems to be sufficiently reworked enough. So why are you even naming it Straw Dogs?
Mm-hmm.
Why are you even setting yourself up for that comparison?
Right. It's like, if you'll remember, I think it was 2006, there was news that The Wild Bunch was going to be remade, and it was going to focus on Mexican drug dealers. It was going to take place in Mexico, but it would be very current, obviously. And I thought, well, why even call it The Wild Bunch then?
Yeah.
You know, that's... So, it's a long...
At the same time, I don't think it's anything to capitalize on. I mean, I don't know how many people are going to rush to see.
You're absolutely right.
Based on the name Straw Dogs.
It doesn't have the if you're going on today's movie going public, that's not going to have, like, when they see that trailer, they're not going to be, oh my God, you know, cool Straw Dogs. They're not going to even know what you're talking about for the most part, I'm afraid. So
yeah. So it's a curious project, and then I'll start shooting. Soon, I think, in the next couple of weeks.
It's interesting casting. I am curious about it, but I agree with you. Why even come up with a new name?
Apparently, Kate Bosworth, this is a really strong, strong character. They say she's going to be doing some difficult things in this movie.
Okay.
He has a good track record of writing good female characters.
He does. I mean, and the best, obviously, being The Contender.
Right. Speaking of good female characters, you saw Potter.
What was that?
You saw Harry Potter.
I saw Harry Potter, yes. yeah, I like how you got into that. It's very interesting. Yeah, we talked about that last week, but, what do you want to know? Because Chris saw it as well, and I guess we'll talk to him about it the next time he's on, but what do you want to know?
Well, I haven't watched the Harry Potter movie, so I'm in the dark about them, but tell me your thoughts compared to the remainder of the series on this one.
I'm a big fan, I think, as we said on the last show, of the third one, the one that was directed by Alfonso Cuarón, and that marked, I think, the series' transition from strictly a children's fantasy film almost to more darker, more adult films, and that's a transition film, and I really appreciated that. And The Goblet of Fire was good, and The Order of the Phoenix, I thought, was incredible. And then we have this one, which is all like sort of like the middle of the story. I have to tell people this. Don't walk in cold to this film. If you haven't seen the others and you're not familiar with the books or anything, I can't imagine. I mean, I can just imagine walking out within the first 5 minutes because you're not going to know what's going on. But if this film has any problem, it's just that you're waiting for the end because we got one more book, but it's broken up into two parts for two films. So they're really dragging this one out. But it's an interesting chapter. The acting is particularly good in this one. Jim Broadbent is in it, and he's very good. And Michael Gambon is the most that he's been given as Dumbledore, and he's fantastic. He walks away with the movie, I think.
Yeah, he's great.
Very good in this because he fililled in for Richard Harris, who passed away. He played the same character in the first two films, and this is the most that they've given him. And I think Jim Broadbent stand out very well. Another character I like a lot in this is Helena Bonham Carter, and she's very good. I mean, these films, if they're going to be remembered for anything, they gave all the great living British actors work. And they're all incredible, even in the smallest parts. It's a good film. If you've been following the series, I don't think you'll have any trouble with it, and you'll enjoy it. I wouldn't walk in cold to it, though.
Yeah. I don't think that many people do.
No,
I
have a friend back in college who had never seen Godfather 1 or 2, but saw Part 3, and he loved it. He loved Part 3. I go, "Why, have you seen the first two?" He goes, "No." I was like, "Really?" And I go, "You followed that?" He says, "Yeah." I'm like, "Really?" He says, "Yeah." I'm like, "Okay, you know, if you say so." So I always think,
well,
that.
maybe it takes not seeing Godfather 1 and 2 to truly love Godfather 3.
I think so. I mean, I liked it, but yeah, if you've never seen the first two, the third one, yeah, this is awesome.
Yeah. So Harry Potter brought in just under $160 million for its 5 days, which means that Chris is the winner of our...
Yeah, I blew that one, too. Thought about that this morning.
I blew it by 40 mil. Wow.
I blew it by 25.
followed by Ice Age, which is doing great business, and Transformers in third place. Transformers, which has already made almost $364 million.
You know, while we're not crazy about this kind of film, because, I mean, I like the first one, I won't lie to you, and this one just seemed like kind of almost lazy, but I am encouraged in one sense that people are going to the movies. Not so much for this movie, but that people are getting out there and that the movies are doing well. Despite all these things we hear about the movie industry is dying, I know that it's not the kind of movie we want to see doing well, but people are at least going out and they're going to the movies. And that's more important than anything else. It means the industry is alive and well.
I suppose.
I know. And I know that's anathema of the show, but it is... You know, the film, it's like, God, you've been using Sanskrit a lot with also Bruno. It is what it is. That's the film. It's dumb. It's young, dumb, and full of cum. That's what Transformers 2 is.
Right. It is what it is, but it isn't what I want it to be.
No, it's not. And here's the thing. It as we go on to the next one, it's going to be even more than you don't want it to be. And then the fourth
it's just
one.
Gonna be, yeah, greater and greater levels of what I don't want it to be.
Yeah, but what did Don Murphy? I keep thinking of what Don Murphy said. Look, we'll just get a new cast of people by 4 or 5. What he said on our show. You know, he said we just have the right formula. We put different people. No one cares. We're just going to keep cranking them out until it's no longer profitable.
Yeah, yeah, that's just it.
Mm-hmm.
Beating a dead Transformer. But you saw something that a lot of people are championing.
And I'm going to champion it in so many ways over the next couple of weeks. 500 Days of Summer is not only one of the best films of the summer, but one of the best films of the year.
Mm.
It is magnificent, and I would really strongly recommend people go out to see it. I don't like to proselytize and preach, but this movie is really worth your time. It is an honest look at relationships and love. And the performances by the two leads are exquisite. Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Zoe Deschanel, they just work magic together.
Mm-hmm.
And this film is just incredible. I actually compare it to two other really great and underrated films this year, Away We Go and Adventureland. They're very honest looks at life.
Are the comparisons to Garden State unwarranted?
Garden State is a very accurate comparison, as is another film that came out years after, Rocket Science. They're just really on. And let me throw in Lime Life that came out earlier this year with Alec Baldwin and Emma Roberts, which is a coming-of-age story set in, I think, 1980. They're all warranted comparisons. But this movie is just, to watch these people, and even the smaller performances and the musical selections and the way it's told, I don't think the movie, for me at least, the movie doesn't strike a false note.
Mm-hmm.
It's just wonderful.
I'm a big fan of Joseph Gordon-Levitt, too.
Isn't he incredible?
He is good.
I mean, this guy has been in so many different films, even in something that wasn't, like, crazy about, like Killshot.
He still
manages to make me want to watch the movie, or even something like Havoc or something. He just has this, I never thought, as I kept saying after watching the movie, I never thought the guy from Third Rock from the Sun, this kid from, would turn out to be this incredible powerhouse actor.
He and, who's the girl in that with him?
Zoe Deschanel?
Yeah. They do the scene from Sid and Nancy.
Oh, dude, that's hysterical.
Have you seen that, where Levitt actually plays Nancy?
Yes, I saw it. It's hysterical.
That's great. If they were to recast Sid and Nancy for a remake, who would you cast? Would you cast Courtney Love as Nancy?
Well, she was in Sid and Nancy. She had a part in that.
Did she? Courtney Love?
Courtney Love was in that movie and another Alex Cox movie, Straight to Hell. And this is and she doesn't look the same. She's definitely heavier, if you will. But she's in both of those films. She had been around. Courtney Love had been around for a long time before she met Kurt Cobain. She had been on the scene.
Mm.
But who would I cast in that? God, it's hard. Gary Oldman and Nancy Spungen. Who would be by today's standards? This is very interesting. No, this is very interesting. You could see Sid Vicious. Let's go with British actors. I'd say the Daniel Radcliffe from Harry Potter, and Sienna Miller.
Wow, I was gonna go with Jason Schwartzman and Juliet Lewis.
Dude, I would start lining up right now for that.
As Sid and Nancy. The other casting news, and this might be a rumor. I think one site said it was just a false rumor, and other sites have been going with it as truth. But Robert Rodriguez is making Machete, the fake trailer that he made for the Grindhouse double feature with Danny Trejo. He's making it into a feature film.
No, we've known about it, but it does seem like it's really going to be a reality now.
Well, yeah, the rumor is that Jonah Hill and Robert De Niro have been cast in it.
Now, I've been hearing about De Niro, but what the hell is Jonah Hill going to play?
The white dude with the fro. I don't know.
He's perfect for it. He's got my vote right there.
Yeah, I would cast him as Sid, personally.
Dude, he'd be an awesome Sid Vicious. Oh, my God, Michael Cera could be Nancy.
Michelle Rodriguez will play Luz. Jonah Hill will play Julio. And Robert De Niro will play Senator McLaughlin.
This could actually be very promising.
A big starring role for Danny Trejo.
Dude, he has always has my vote.
Danny Trejo?
Mm-hmm.
I just like saying it.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Danny, you're always welcome on our show.
We've invited him. We invited him last week, actually.
Cool.
Yeah, not very cool. He hasn't accepted. But anyway, we'll get him. Stay tuned to our blogs and Facebook, MySpace, Twitter, and our information here on our homepage to find out who will be our guests in the next couple of weeks.
Cool.
I have a feeling there's some exciting announcements coming up. And also we have tributes to some movies coming up. We got our tribute to Casino coming up. And I think Chris is going to join us again on Wednesday, and we'll go over more movie news and such.
Cool.
Jerry, was there anything else you wanted to go over tonight?
No. I think we covered Harry Potter, 500 Days of Summer, Bruno, and the Straw Dogs thing, which I found fascinating. And I did, I'm glad you brought up Machete, because that was, everyone, I think that and Thanksgiving were the favorite trailers and the favorite parts of Grindhouse.
I rewatch those trailers, and that Thanksgiving really is something else.
That is, and it is something though interesting about Inglourious Basterds is that Eli Roth has a big part as an actor.
Yeah.
In the film. And a lot of people give him a
give him the shaft and everything. But I find it personally fascinating, and I actually look forward to him in this movie. I'm very curious to see how he pulls it off.
Yeah, I'm sure he'll be great, and in typical Tarantino fashion, it's a very colorful, diverse cast.
It is.
Yeah, Mike Myers and the, you know, on and on and on, very diverse. Okay. So there was something else I was going to say, but I forgot. So sorry. We'll
have
to pick up on it Wednesday. Wednesday night, 10 o'clock, we'll be back. Join us on Facebook or MySpace or Twitter. We're there.
We're all over the social networking empire.
Yes. And we will see you back here on Wednesday night, guys. We appreciate you showing up tonight.
All right,
thanks so much.
Thank you. Good night, everyone.
Thank you.